Today, At the Limits, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 27th of July 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And in this week's News Digest, we look at the latest from central bankers, more record highs on the exchanges, more 40 buildings, and a further pulse check on property prices. And in passing, it's worth noting that the IMF reduced their global growth forecast down again, but slightly. And once again, I'm going to start with the international markets, not least because we are highly influenced by what's going on there in terms of demand for our exports, the price of money via the financial markets, and sentiment more generally. But if you want to jump directly to the Australian section, the time for that is shown below. And in the US on Friday, sentiment was positive, with gains for Google's parent Alphabet, Starbucks, and T-Mobile, powering the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq to new highs. The gains were due to strong earnings on Thursday for Alphabet, up 10%, and Starbucks, up 8.9%, as well as the federal government's approval of T-Mobile's $26 billion deal to merge with Sprint. T-Mobile climbed 5.6%, and Sprint rose 7.4%. The S&P 500 closed at a record 3,026 with a 0.74% gain. The Nasdaq Composite jumped 1.11% to 8,330. And they also reached new intraday highs as well. The Dow was up a more modest 0.19% to 27,192 as it continued to be held back by weaknesses in shares of Boeing, which is struggling to get its 737 MAX jetliner back into service. The plane has been grounded since March after fatal crashes of the plane in Ethiopia and Indonesia, and it's possible that the plane won't go back into service until January next year. Boeing was off 0.9% and subtracted 21 points from the Dow on Friday, and it's off 8.6% over the week. Economic news included the Commerce Department's report that US gross domestic product grew 2.1% in the second quarter, compared with a 1.8% estimate. Growth decelerated in the second quarter, but not by as much as Wall Street thought it would, as tariffs and the global slowdown weighed on the US economy. The 2.1% reading was down from the first quarter's 3.1% and the weakest since the first quarter of 2017 when President Donald Trump took office. Consumer and government spending helped propel GDP in the April to June period, while a pullback in business investment weighed on the number. Personal consumption expenditure rose 4.3%. That's the best performance since the fourth quarter of 2017. Government consumption expenditures and gross investment rose 5%. That's the fastest pace since the second quarter of 2009, as the economy was coming out of the Great Recession. At the same time, gross private domestic investment tumbled 5.5%, and that's the worst since the fourth quarter of 2015, as spending on structures slumped 10.6%. The decline pulled a full percentage point from the final GDP number. Falling inventories also acted as a 0.86 percentage point drag. However, the underlying numbers in the report seem to take the steam out of the recession fears that have been much talked about among economists and policymakers at the Federal Reserve. The S&P 500 was up 1.7% for the week, with the Nasdaq up 2.23%, and the Dow added 0.14%. For the year, the S&P 500 is up 20.7%, with the Nasdaq up 25.5% and the Dow up 16.6%. The volatility index was down 4.55% to 1216, and that's down 23% from a month back, so risk has abated. investors are holding the line on stronger economic growth if, as expected, the Federal Reserve cuts its key interest rate next week. The Fed decision is due on Wednesday afternoon, and most are expecting at least a drop of 2 to 2.25%, down from 2.25% to 2.5% now. Of course, the Trump administration has been pushing for lower rates to push the value of the dollar lower against major currencies, and there was some talk this week that the administration might sell dollars to push the greenback lower. The US dollar index, which measures the dollar against a basket of currencies, is up 25% since the end of 2009, and it was at 99.76, up 0.09% on the day. Interest rates were flat to lower, with the 10-year yield falling to 2.072% from Thursday's 2.083%. The three-month rate ended at 2.123% and remains higher than the long-term rates, indicating risks ahead. Oil prices moved up slightly, with West Texas Intermediate crude oil up 0.3% to $56.19 a barrel. Given the troubles in the Middle East, it's worth considering why oil prices have not reacted more. Well, first, demand for oil will weaken as macroeconomic indicators and the lack of optimism that the trade war between the US and China will be resolved are driving market sentiment now and outweighing concerns that the supply of oil from the Middle East could be disrupted. And then Iran hasn't actually done anything yet that has impeded or threatened crude oil exports. None of the sabotaged tankers in June were carrying crude oil, and the tankers seized earlier this week was empty. Very often, when an incident is first reported, it appears as though crude oil has been affected directly. Then geopolitical risk has already been priced into the oil market. This became clear last week when oil prices actually dropped after it was reported that the Trump administration and Iran might engage in a diplomatic process. That news was subsequently quickly refuted and prices rose again, demonstrating that markets have already priced in this type of geopolitical risk in the Middle East, and only a drop in tension would require an adjustment in the market. And the United States is producing around 12 million barrels per day of oil and is now exporting growing amounts of that oil to customers who are purchasing it to replace some Middle East oil. American oil production and exports help keep a lid on prices despite the sanctions on Iran or the Iranian threat of oil shipments in the Gulf. The question becomes, how long can these four factors keep oil prices down if Iranian aggression continues or even escalates? Gold futures for August delivery was up 0.28% to $1,418.60. And gold has been soaring as investors and traders continue to buy precious metals. As long as the central banks keep their dovish outlook, precious metals may continue to outperform, and it's worth noting that currently gold has been soaring higher despite a stronger US dollar. Often in the past, when the US dollar has been strong, gold has been weak, but not this time around. Money keeps pouring into the US dollar from foreign countries, and it's still seen as a reserve currency in many people's minds. After all, Europe and Japan have negative rates, and many investors are now losing faith in the euro. But after the US dollar, gold may be the logical winner in this environment. As long as central banks keep their dovish tone, gold is the one asset class that should continue to benefit. But of course, even the price of gold is manipulated. And there were more bank troubles in China being reported following Baoshang's rescue less than 2 months ago. It appears that the Bank of Zhihu is following the same path and is about to be seized by the government. According to Reuters and Bloomberg, Bank of Zhihu recently met financial institution in its home province to discuss measures to deal with liquidity problems, and in a parallel bailout to that of Baoshang, the bank was in talks to, quote, introduce strategic investors, after a report that China's financial regulators are seeking to resolve its liquidity problems sent its dollar-denominated debt plunging. Officials, including those from the People's Bank of China and China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission, recently held a meeting with the institution in their home province to discuss measures to resolve the lender's liquidity issues. This is important as the Bank of Zhihu is the second most reliant on interbank financing, particularly non-bank financial institution deposits, among more than 200 local banks, according to UBS. In response to market fears, the bank issued a statement on Thursday that currently Bank of Zhihu business operations are normal overall, which, however, did not refer to its liquidity situation. Recently, the bank's board of directors and some major shareholders have been in talks with several institutions that wish to and have the ability to become strategic investors, adding that talks have been going smoothly. China's banks are worth watching for a Lehman-style event ahead. China's Shanghai Composite ended up 0.24% to 2,944, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index fell 0.5% after the city reported that it saw its biggest annual drop in exports in almost 3.5 years in June. The US dollar Chinese yuan was at 6.88, up 0.11%. The Boris effect lifted the UK FTSE on Friday to 7,549, up 0.8% on the day, and that's 0.54% over the week and 12.2% over the year. While the language around Brexit has changed, there are many risks ahead, including a possible general election, a forced exit in October, and issues with the Irish border, so not much really has changed. And in a speech following the European Central Bank ECB interest rate and monetary policy decisions, President Mario Draghi sounded more upbeat on the economy than investors expected, saying the risk of a recession in the region was low. And some traders interpreted his message as the central bank would not be as aggressive in its easing measures, and that the US Federal Reserve could follow suit when it meets next week. Reports after the meeting said, however, that an interest rate cut in September appeared certain, while government bond purchases and a revamped policy message are also likely. An interest rate cut of 10 basis points in September looks like a done deal now, said one analyst. The 10-year German government bond yield initially hit a record low of minus 0.463%, but ended the day up slightly at minus 0.407%. This is what negative interest rates look like. As Bloomberg put it, Mario Draghi is shouting louder than ever for help with the euro area economy, and still no one is listening. After stating that the outlook is getting worse and worse, the European Central Bank president said on Thursday that it is unquestionable that governments will need to pitch in with fiscal measures if conditions keep deteriorating. And Draghi's 8-year term, which ends in October, has been marked by negative interest rates, bond purchases, and bank loans, while he's promising that the ECB could add more stimulus and looks poised to do so in September. The comments suggest that the central bank is getting close to the limits of its powers, yet Germany, which has a budget surplus and which can borrow money at sub-zero rates, doesn't see the problem, even as its own manufacturing sector contracts. The ECB has been in crisis-fighting mode for years, combating the aftermath of the global financial meltdown, the Eurozone's own sovereign debt struggles, and a flirtation with deflation. And it's unleashed innovative instruments, including the 2.6 trillion euros of quantitative easing and ultra-cheap bank loans that have flooded the region with liquidity and promised to keep rates low for as long as needed to revive price growth. For all the success that the institution claims, such as 6 years of economic growth and more than 10 million new jobs, inflation remains far short of its goal. Professional forecasters cut their longer-term outlook for consumer price growth to a record low of 1.7%, according to an ECB survey published on Friday. That's a risk to the central bank's credibility, especially with trade tensions and Brexit threatening a new downturn. And this highlights the moral hazard. Politicians prefer to step back and leave the heavy lifting to central banks. But we are now reaching the limits. Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell has said it's no good for monetary policy to be the main game in town. And Christine Lagarde, who's leaving as head of the International Monetary Fund to succeed Draghi, has said that in the next slump, the world will need fiscal stimulus wherever possible. And part of the problem may be the extent to which the remit of central banks has grown. Since the 1990s, they've increasingly gained operational independence and been given inflation targets. And while that's designed to stop politicians from stoking growth with low interest rates before elections, it's meant that central banks have done the heavy lifting to keep the economy expanding while governments try to reduce their debt loads, though of course often, as in Australia, at the cost of rising private debt. European stocks were almost flat on Friday, with the pan-European Euro stocks futures up just 0.03%, while the German DAX futures was up 0.15%. And Deutsche Bank reported a €3.15 billion loss in the second quarter due to a large restructuring charge that wiped out what would have otherwise been a very modest profit. This decline is mainly due to our decision to exit substantially all of our equity sales and trading businesses, the bank said in a statement. And the bank's shares have fallen more than 30% in the last 12 months, hit by a host of scandals relating to historical anti-money laundering failures. They ended on Friday down 0.25% to 7.113. The euro slid 0.16% on Friday to 1.11 against the US dollar. And Bitcoin slid another 0.92% on Friday to end at 9,796 as we write this. And you can watch our recent show, Some Truths Around Bitcoin, where we discuss some of the questions around cryptos. There are a few things going on here. For example, miners are accumulating and retail investors are piling in expectations of a Bitcoin halving price spike. But a new historical analysis called the Myth of Cryptocurrency Halving Events found no evidence that cryptocurrencies experiencing a halving event outperform the broader market in the months leading up to or following a reduction in miner rewards. The theory behind the halving price increase is basically that halving reduces the supply of new coins coming onto the market, thereby making each one more valuable. With Bitcoin, for example, miners currently earn 12.5 Bitcoins per block, or around 1,800 coins per day. Miners tend to sell the coins immediately to cover the costs of electricity and lock in profits, although there has been recent reports that miners are holding in expectations of a halving price increase. That means up to 1,800 new Bitcoins come onto the market each day. After May next year, though, only around 900 new Bitcoins will be added each day, thereby reducing supply dramatically. Endless numbers of pundits believe that based on the previous Bitcoin halving events, the price of Bitcoin will skyrocket, but there are so many other factors in play that the outcome is hard to predict. Others are predicting more price falls ahead as the recent trends extend. So now to the Australian scene. I discuss Philip Lowe's recent speech in my post, The RBA on Inflation Targeting, where we pointed out that the bank is now seeing rates lower for longer. But what we are also seeing is a post-rationalisation of their previous poor forecasting and rate decisions, centred on the new low target for employment of 4.5%. But the fact is real unemployment is significantly higher and inflation is also higher. So their monetary settings are just plain wrong. As Westpac put it in their excellent red book, unemployment is more likely to be 5 point something rather than 4 point something next year. And rates will go even lower. And you can watch our show, An Updated Economic Snapshot, for more detail. The RBA shares central bank groupthink, but the real blame needs to be placed with the political class who are happy to stand back and claim all is well, when in fact the true economic status is significantly worse, and fiscal stimulus should be on their agenda. But of course, because of the doctrinal commitment to the budget surplus, they prefer to look away. The moral hazard here is that central bankers have been doing the heavy lifting with unintended consequences in terms of rising debt in a low interest rate environment. But household debt is too high. And as I discussed with John Adams and Dr. Peter Brain on the Interests of the People channel, Australia's foreign debt bubble means there is no escaping Armageddon. We have an international debt problem with more than $1 trillion of net international debt owing, quite a bit of which is short term and directly connected to the banks funding their loan books. What could possibly go wrong? Peter's joint authored book, Credit Code Red, is highly recommended. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And the RBA nonsense has been in the headlights again this week. For example, Christopher Joy in the AFR said, when the RBA slashed its cash rate from 4.75% to 1.5% between 2011 and 2016, it repeatedly argued that this would not trigger a re-leveraging of household balance sheets and or a new double-digit house price boom, which is exactly what happened. Most embarrassingly for the RBA, two of its top researchers, Trent Saunders and Peter Tulip, published a detailed academic paper shortly thereafter, proving that almost all of the stunning increases in house prices between 2013 and 17 were indeed attributable to the reduction in mortgage rates. So, he says, forgive me if when Lowe says that the recent RBA cuts will not reignite the housing bubble, my mental reflex is to dismiss this rhetoric as non-credible. The recovery will accelerate as cheaper mortgage rates grip and the banking regulators' easier interest rate serviceability tests expand purchasing power further. Yet Lowe, in answer to questions on Thursday, said there has been a significant tightening in lending standards. In some respects, it seems some institutions have become excessively risk averse, and many people in the community feel that they have already borrowed too much, and now they are in a period of consolidating the balance sheet rather than going out to take on more debt, even if there are low interest rates. The supply of credit and the demand for credit is less than it was a few years ago. And he said, there will be a modest pickup in borrowing, but because of reduced credit supply and reduced demand from households, I don't see it likely to go into a rapid period of leveraging. If we did, then we would have to rethink. The primary concern is an extended period of rapid credit growth in an environment where households are already leveraged, and we don't see that as particularly likely. And I've just seen a pig fly past the window. And returns from property in 2018-19 were negative, according to CoreLogic. Over the 18-19 financial year, total returns from residential property recorded a fall of 3.3%. Returns were down from the previous year, and it was the only financial year since at least 2005-06 that total residential property returns were negative. To put that in context, housing returns last year were worse than those recorded during the financial crisis and during the 2010-12 housing downturn. The combination of falling values and historically low rental yields have driven total returns into negative territory. And looking at the national figures in the context of the combined capital cities and combined regional markets, it shows that returns have reduced over the year across both regions. However, combined capital city returns have fallen down 4.5%, while combined regional market returns remained mildly positive at 1.6%. For the combined capital cities, it was the weakest returns on record and the first negative annual return, while across the combined regional markets, it was the weakest annual return since 2008-09. And actually, if you include the costs of borrowing as we do, the returns are even worse. And if you add the maintenance costs, etc., you are in deep negative territory. The auction clearance rates were interesting again, if on low volumes. Sydney hit 72.8% and Melbourne 67.5%, both higher than last year in terms of percentages, but lower if you count the actual number of auctions. And the gap between listed auctions and reported auctions remains very large. So maybe some stirring, but certainly not a clear rebound yet. And according to CoreLogic, values are stabilising in some centres. So looking first at the annual movements based on the CoreLogic series, you can see that prices in Sydney are just a little bit off their lows. Melbourne following suit. Brisbane has been falling, but now is showing a small recovery. Adelaide is continuing to slide. Perth is also looking pretty weak. And the five cities average is just up a little. So looking at the CoreLogic indices to the 25th of July, over the last week, Sydney prices rose 0.02%. Over the month, they rose 0.11%. Over the quarter, they fell 0.45%. Annually, they fell 9.1%. And from the peak, they're now down 14.8%. In Melbourne, they rose 0.03% over the last week. They rose 0.09% over the last month. They've fallen 0.18% over the last quarter. They've fallen 8.5% over the last year. And from peak, they're down 10.8%. In Brisbane, prices rose 0.31% over the last week. They rose 0.24% over the last month. They're down 0.81% over the quarter. They're down 2.3% over the last year and down 2.4% from peak. In Adelaide, prices fell 0.11% over the last week. They fell 0.26% over the last month. They're down 0.47% over the quarter. They're down 0.6% annually, and they're down 1.2% from the last peak. In Perth, they're down 0.39% over the month. Over the quarter, they're down 2.19%. Annually, they're down 8.9%. And from peak, they're still down 20.1%. And in the major five cities, prices rose 0.05% over the last week, 0.04% over the month. They fell 0.63% over the quarter. They've fallen 7.7% annually. And from peak, they're down 10.7%. And a reminder that all of those are averages, but there are considerable variations. For example, houses in Chatswood, New South Wales 2067, are down 19.2% over the past year, while Cronulla units in 2230 are down 11%, while houses in Mandurah in Western Australia, that's 6210, are down 28.6%, but over a longer period. Averages mask. And Domain reported further home price falls in the June quarter. Median house prices fell by 0.4% across the combined capital cities over the June quarter, with prices down 6.4% year on year. Turning to apartments, values fell by 0.2% across the combined capital cities in the June quarter and by 5.3% year on year, but they are claiming a turnaround is happening. Quote, the 8 weeks since the election were significant in further bolstering the recovering housing market and were not included in their entirety in the June figures. Current data and observations affirm the trends reflected in the quarterly report, and consumers' surveys indicate confidence is building. Things are turning around. Well, we'll see. There were more construction faults reported this week, with residents of the Joshua apartment block in Alexandra facing legal action after a private certifier illegally allowed them to move in, despite the building developer failing to carry out extensive construction work to make it safe, as reported by the Sydney Morning Herald. And the New Daily reported that Australia's second tallest building still under construction is under a cloud, with claims of loud cracking sounds and windows that no longer open. The 319-metre Australia 108 building in Melbourne's South Bank will boast more than 1,000 apartments over 100 floors, but the Victorian Building Authority, the VBA, confirmed to the New Daily that it had visited the site on Thursday and requested to see building plans. Industry leaders have told of reports the building, still under construction, has cracks in its plaster and has experienced movement. The VBA did not disclose the specific reasons for its probe, but said that its investigation was ongoing. There are no structural issues with Australia 102. The building is still under construction and some slight movements is to be anticipated in certain circumstances, a multiplex spokesperson said. And once completed, Australia 108 will be Melbourne's tallest building. And a recent study highlighted the high number of building defects, especially in high-rise in New South Wales, a worrying statistic. As Nine News put it, a Nine News investigation reveals homeowners in the postcodes of earmarked priority precincts, growth and urban renewal areas have more than double the rates of defects compared to those where regular planning rules apply. Worst affected are owners in suburbs around Sydney's west, southwest and northwest. And the revelation comes after it's emerged residents have been forced to evacuate at least four Sydney apartment blocks because of defects in Parramatta, Zetland, Mascot and Olympic Park. Nevertheless, the state government appears to be attempting to wash their hands of accountability from the sanctioned building frenzy, which saw development applications assessed in as little as 24 hours. Publicly reported defects are just the tip of the iceberg, as thousands of homeowners are understood to be suffering quietly for fear of devaluing their homes or are gagged by developers' non-disclosure agreements. Overall, the highest levels of defects were recorded in suburbs like Kellyville, Rouse Hill, Campbelltown, Marsden Park, Box Hill, Westmead, Seven Hills, Schofields and Macquarie Park. And elsewhere, we continue to get reports of leaking plumbing and wastewater, as well as faulty wiring and panels. For example, via 2GB, listener Erica has contacted the Ben Fordham Show after she was left homeless when a sewage leak made her Parramatta apartment unlivable. The Altitude by Meriton building was built in 2017 and has been Erica's home for the past 2 years. She told Ben Fordham she noticed a huge spray of water coming out of the side of an empty apartment, five levels above. Management has told her and a housemate that their home has been infected by septic and they need to leave immediately. And the latest CoreLogic chip report, as reported in Smart Property Investment, which uses data from the Cordell Construction Database, indicated that New South Wales unit construction peaked at an unprecedented level in 2018. The report said that there is likely to be an extended period before new supply turns around. However, the number of new approved units and apartment projects for May is approximately 75% of the three-year median, while the total value of unit projects reported as commenced construction is 63% lower on a rolling 12-month basis. It said the latest indicators to the end of June showed 62% of Sydney off-the-plan apartments were settling, with a valuation lower than the contract price, which will present headwinds for developers seeking finance for new projects. And similar to New South Wales, the report noted that Victoria is also moving through a historic peak in unit construction and is experiencing some challenges due to an oversupply in specific sectors of the market. The number of new unit projects reported as commenced in 2019 is less than half that recorded in the preceding 12 months. In Melbourne, 46% of off-the-plan units are settling with a valuation lower than their contract price, causing lenders to remain cautious of the lending settlement risk that exists within the sector. And according to Morgan Stanley, a recovery in housing construction activity is still yet to start in Australia, and building materials providers have more pain to come. In a study of less material-intensive apartment activity versus more intensive detached houses, the broker has created its Morgan Stanley Intensity Adjusted Index, which signals the worst is yet to be felt. Analysts said the downturn will hit worst in the financial year 20, with forecasts suggesting activity won't trough until late financial year 21. The Australian residential exposed building materials stocks have enjoyed a post-election bounce that we believe has come too early and ignores the pain yet to come. So what will all the changes in lending standards, interest rates, and mortgage serviceability mean to home prices? That, of course, is the big question. And now some of the analysts are coming out with their views. For example, Gareth Aird at the CBA wrote this week, "We update our dwelling price forecast nationally and extend the profile to the end of 2020. Our quantitative assessment of the residential market, overlaid with our qualitative views, lead us to conclude that national property prices are most likely to rise modestly over the second half of 2019 and lift by around 3% in 2020. The risks look to the upside. As is generally the case, there is likely to be significant variation in outcomes by capital city. We expect Sydney and Melbourne to outperform relative to the national average. Australia's two biggest cities experienced the largest declines over the past 2 years, and the leading indicators have firmed the most in Sydney and Melbourne. We do not expect a V-shaped recovery in prices, however, for these three reasons. First, the rental market remains soft. Second, lenders are expected to continue with a heightened focus on the verification of borrower income and expenses. And third, potential home buyer exuberance will be somewhat tempered by the previous 2 years of deflating prices." And he also said that the reduction in mortgage rates will have a greater impact on credit growth than otherwise, as prospective borrowers will be offered a bigger loan amount than before the APRA amendments. On some calculations, they said, the changes are likely to increase the borrowing capacity of a potential home buyer by up to 14%. Now, it's worth noting that the RBA Governor Lowe stated that the APRA moves is complementary to monetary policy, not a substitute. And finally is the local markets. The ASX 100 fell 0.3% on Friday to close at 5,615, though up 1.36% in the past week, 1.68% in the past month, and 20.45% year to date. It hit a new high of 5,631.8, driven by, of course, the prospect of lower interest rates driving the asset bubble higher. The financials index closed at 6,502, down 0.66%, though up 16.1% year-to-date, still well below its all-time peak back in 2007 of 7,454. The local volatility index was down 1.33% to 11.037, down 38.4% year-to-date. The markets are less spooked at the moment. Among the banks, ANZ closed at 27.78, down 0.64%, but not helped by ASIC, who's commenced proceedings in the federal court against ANZ over allegations relating to charging of fees for periodic payments. These fees were charged on at least 1.3 million occasions, alleges ASIC, and the commission contends that the bank first became aware of the risks in July 2011. CBA closed at 82.59, down 0.49%, and is 14.09% higher than year-to-date. NAB ended at 28.49, down 0.42%, up 18.36% over the year, and Westpac finished at 28.57, down 1%, and up 14.1% from January. Among the regionals, Bendigo and Adelaide Bank closed at 11.50, down 0.78%, and Suncorp fell 0.81% to 13.52. AMP fell 0.82% to end at 1.82, and Genworth, the mortgage insurer, finished at 2.96, down 1.66%, as S&P Global Ratings said this is lowered to A, from A+, its insurer financial strength and issuer credit ratings on Genworth. The reduction in its revenues and capital base over the period means that the insurer's ability to weather large shocks has diminished, in our view, they said. While Genworth maintains a leading market share in the LMI market, we expect increased competition from banks, LMI captives, and a new entrant to place pressure on Genworth's market positions and earnings. More risks to the sector. Aggregator Mortgage Choice closed at 1.14, down 1.72%, and is down 44.39% over the past 3 years. The Aussie-US dollar fell below 70 cents on the back of the RBA's dovish comments and ended at 69.1, down 0.58% on Friday, and the Aussie gold cross was at 2,051, up 0.87%, and the Aussie Bitcoin cross was at 14,265, down 0.49%. So standing back, it's fair to say markets are salivating for the lower for longer rate picture as central banks continue their efforts to shift inflation higher. But as we've discussed before, this is unlikely to work and will simply amplify debt further and drive asset prices higher for a time before the reckoning. But to me, the main takeout this week is the moral hazard which central bankers have created, essentially allowing politicians off the hook. This is the bigger disgrace and one which will ultimately cost us all. As Lowe said this week, monetary policy is not an end in itself. Its focus should be on the greater welfare of all Australians, whereas the combined efforts of rate cutting, loose lending and government inaction are benefiting some, but the majority are being crushed. And around the world, the interests of the people are being betrayed. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.